So this is week three of our Joseph study. We're going to just keep walking through it. Let me take a little minute here and recap and catch you up, or if this is your first week, welcome. So we're studying Joseph. This is Old Testament Joseph, the guy with the coat of many colors. And so far we've been through Genesis 37 and Genesis 38, and a few things that I was trying to reiterate, and I'll continue to reiterate, is that I want us to see Joseph's story as a part of the bigger story in Genesis. There's a bigger story going on in Genesis and the whole Bible, really, and Joseph's story plays a role in that. Sometimes we get used to just plucking these stories out on their own, and I want us to see how these things connect. Something I did the first time, and we'll talk a little bit again, is since Joseph's story is part of the larger story in Genesis, what's important about that is Joseph's story is going to connect several of the themes that have been running through Genesis already. And so, Matt, whenever you can pull that slide, we were talking about how God has made promises to his people, right? All throughout Genesis, he's making promises to his people. And so I wanted to put this up there. Hopefully you can see it to some degree, because as I'm reiterating these promises, it can be challenging because there's a lot of names. There's a lot of people we're dealing with, and even as I'm jumping back and forth. So what I wanted to just show you is, if you can see the top of this, this is like a little family tree of the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the top on the left, you see Abraham. And so I said that God made a promise to Abraham for land, seed, and blessing. And what that means is God promised that he was going to give Abraham and his descendants a particular piece of land. He also promised that he would give him seed, meaning many descendants. He said, Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. And then he promised to bless Abraham and his descendants, and not only bless them, but bless anybody who blesses them. So that promise was made to Abraham, and then God reiterated that promise to Abraham's son, Isaac. So the same promise God gave to Abraham, he then told it to his son, Isaac. And then he reiterated the same promise to Isaac's son, Jacob. Okay? And so what we're doing in Genesis 37 to about 50, it's the story of Joseph, but really it's actually going to culminate with what happens to Jacob. Because Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we call them the patriarchs in the Bible. And so this last part is really telling us the story of what's to come of Jacob's family and what's to come of these promises that God has made to Jacob. And then we got to Joseph's story in Genesis 37, and we were showing this crazy dynamic that Jacob, he ends up having 12 children. You can see they're numbered here. And he has these 12 children with four different women. We see Leah, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah. And the story is that Jacob wanted to marry Rachel, but he got tricked into marrying Leah. So then he had to work 7 extra years to get Rachel. And then once he got the two of them, well, Rachel couldn't have children, and Leah did have some children, and so a war raged between who's going to have children. And so now each of the women gave their maids for Joseph or for Jacob to try to have children with. By the end of this thing, Jacob has 12 children. And he's got 12 boys, actually, and he's got the 13th child is a daughter. And so what I wanted to show is that it's interesting here is that Judah, look number 4, from Leah down to Judah, he is one of the children, and then you see Joseph is number 11. And so throughout this story that we're going to be some tonight and continuing on, Joseph and Judah's stories are going to be intersecting. And so in Genesis 37, we see all the siblings from Leah, they turn on Joseph, their own brother. And I said that was Joseph. He was the favored but forsaken son. He's favored by his father, Jacob, because he's of the wife that Jacob loved. And he's favored of God because God gives him these dreams saying, he's saying, hey, Joseph, you're going to rise up above your family. Well, Joseph's brothers hate this, and so they turn on him, and Judah was the one who had the idea of, let's sell our brother into slavery. And so they sell their own brother into slavery, and he's forsaken, and they tell their father, Jacob, that he was eaten by a wild beast, and they use his own robe, dipped it in blood, and they used it to lie to their father and deceive him. And then last week we got into Genesis 38. And right when we started looking at it, we said, well, this is odd. We thought the story was about Joseph. And Genesis 38 is all about Judah, the other brother. And we saw the crazy and graphic story that this was, where Judah leaves his family, he goes to a different land, which is a bad sign, and then he marries a Canaanite woman, bad sign, and then he has three children with that woman, and gives his first son to another Canaanite woman, bad sign. So Judah is making all these terrible decisions, and it's a downward spiral for him. And then we ended it by basically showing how his hypocrisy, when he slept with his daughter-in-law without realizing it, she tricked him because he was supposed to give her his last son to marry, and he didn't. And then it's all revealed at the very end where she reveals his identity to him and everybody around. And I said, why is this story here? What an odd story to have in the midst of the Joseph story. And we mentioned a couple of the reasons. Well, why is this here? One reason is it shows that God works through messy people. And that is comforting because I think every one of us here would agree we're all flawed, messy people. But I also said that story was important because it shows a starting point for Judah. You see in his character in the beginning of this, and he's got a low moral character here. But as the story progresses, that's going to change. But then the last thing I said is this was intentionally put right there in that point of the story to give us a good contrast for Joseph. So today, as we get into it, we're going to see how Judah is very different than his brother Joseph. Okay, so as we walk through Genesis 39 and 40 today, we're going to see, I'll point out some very interesting things that are different about Judah and Joseph. The last thing we said is that Judah was kind of shown, we saw how God worked through Judah's failures. And then I said, today we're going to find out, well, what does it look like for somebody to be faithful? If Judah was a failure, then what does it look like for Joseph being faithful to God? So we're going to see, what does it look like, a faithful servant of God? But I think as we get into it, you're going to see that God's ways are different than our ways. In our ways, we think if I'm faithful to God, everything's going to go well for me. But we're going to find out with Joseph that that is not always the case. And sometimes God intentionally puts faithful people through very difficult circumstances. And he does it for a number of reasons, some of which are to refine them, and some of which are to use them. So we're going to see how that shakes out for Joseph tonight. So if you would, open your Bibles to Genesis 39. And then we're going to get started with Joseph. Now, I had a question last time, so I want to make sure I address it. When we ended Genesis, let's go look at the end of Genesis 37. Or actually, go to the beginning of Genesis 37. And we're going to look at verse 2. Genesis 37, 2. It says, these are the records of the generations of Jacob. And then the next part says, Joseph, when 17 years of age. Okay, so I just wanted to point. Joseph is 17 when the story starts. And then at the end of Genesis 37, Joseph is sold into slavery. And 38 picks up with Judah. But Judah's story takes many years. You got to think, in Judah's story, he leaves home, gets married, has three kids. The kids grow up to where the sons are of age to get married. We're talking a number of years have transpired here. But when we get back to Genesis 39, we're kind of going back in time, and we're getting back to Joseph. So this is the 17-year-old Joseph. And so Genesis 38 with Judah is basically happening parallel to the rest of the story we're going to see with Joseph. Does that make sense? We're kind of going back now? Okay, so now we can start. Let's pick this up in Genesis 39. So Genesis 39:1 starts like this. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And last week I pointed out that with Judah, in the very first verse of 38, it says that Judah departed, but that word also is went down. Judah went down from his family. He left his family. And here, with Joseph, Joseph has been taken down. And it's the same word. He went down. And that's intentional, I believe, with Moses. We're connecting these stories. That's why I said we're going to see some contrasting things with Judah and Joseph. And you think, Judah went down of his own free will. He said, I'm going to need a little space from my family. I want a little spiritual space too, as you can see his decisions. But Joseph, he's forcibly removed from his family. He doesn't have any choice in this matter. He was sold. Okay, so they're both in these foreign lands, and we're going to see how does Joseph handle it. We also saw that he was sold to Potiphar. This is providential. Potiphar is not just any old person. He's one of Pharaoh's officers. And so Joseph could have been sold to any old person and just be a normal field slave, but he's sold to Potiphar. And this man is important, and he's powerful. But what's interesting is notice here in this first verse, Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, and then notice what Potiphar's role is. It says he's the captain of the bodyguard. And I think at first pass, we can read this and it doesn't really mean much to us. And if you think more bodyguard, so he's almost like, one way to describe it is the Secret Service, right? He's protecting Pharaoh. But another interesting way that this word could be used, when I was doing that sermon on Joseph and Daniel and I was seeing all these similarities, this same word is used in Daniel 2, in Daniel 2:14. And let me read. It says, Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to this man Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard. But there's a note here that that word bodyguard can also mean executioner. So actually, when we see that Potiphar is the captain of the bodyguard, and then we realize captain of the executioners, we realize that Joseph is in a bit more dire of a situation than we first realize. So Joseph is in the house of Potiphar, who is the captain of the executioners. And we continue in verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. So right off the bat, we're getting another contrast with Judah and Joseph. Judah, as we said last time, he's almost in the beginning kind of being opposed by God. Remember, two of Judah's three sons die, and it explicitly says that God took their life because they were evil. So Judah's got these evil sons, and God's kind of opposing him, but here, what do we see with Joseph? He's got God's favor. God is with him. When everybody else had deserted Joseph, when his family had deserted him and they had sold him, God is with him. And we see that God is with him, and then because of this, he becomes a successful man. He's in this foreign land, and he becomes very successful. And this is a supernatural success. This is not just a normal amount of success, right? This is clearly God's hands is involved. So much so that Potiphar, a man who is not a God worshiper, he recognizes something is special about this boy. Something is special about him. And so he starts giving more and more responsibility to Joseph. And so it's clear that God is helping Joseph, but something that I thought about, and I said it in the sermon, that really impresses me when you think about Joseph is still involved here. He's not just like a robot. Like, God is blessing what Joseph's doing, but Joseph is actively involved. Remember, I had said, he's in a whole new country. He's a Hebrew, and now he's in Egypt. So that means that's a whole new language. So Joseph is having to learn a whole new language, and he chooses to do it. He chooses. He's saying, I'm going to apply myself. I'm going to work hard. He knows the dreams that God gave him, and he's saying, I'm just going to stay at this. I'm going to serve God right where I am. And I think this is a good, important lesson for all of us. I listened to a sermon on this portion from Alistair Begg. He's a Scottish pastor, and I like his whole summary was, right here, Joseph in Potiphar's house, Joseph is making the most of it. And I think that's important for us because it's easy for us to fall into the trap of, well, if I can only just get into the right job or the right situation in life, then I can be a good servant of the Lord. Or maybe I need to quit my job and go into full-time ministry, and then I could be a good servant of the Lord. But we can see the lesson with Joseph is clearly here. We can make the most of it, and we can be a good servant of the Lord anywhere we are. We don't have to have a perfect situation, and quite honestly, there is no perfect situation. So Joseph, here we see he's making the most of it. And if we continue, he's being blessed, and it goes even farther in verse 5. It came about that from the time he, meaning Potiphar, made Joseph overseer in his house and over all that he owned, look what it says, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he eats. So Potiphar, a pagan, recognizes the blessing. And what does he do? He gives Joseph more responsibility. And what does God do when Potiphar does this to Joseph? God blesses Potiphar's house. And here's why that's significant. As I was talking earlier with that slide about these promises that God made, land, seed, and blessing. God promised Abraham, I'm going to bless you and your descendants. And you know what else he promised? Anyone who blesses you, I will bless. And so in a small way, we're seeing that promise starting to come to pass here through Joseph and Potiphar's house. Potiphar blesses Joseph by giving him more responsibility, and God blesses Potiphar. We also can see that Potiphar trusts Joseph. He puts everything under his charge. I mean, who would do this? You have a slave whom you bought. He's from another land. And by the end of it, he's running the whole show. The only thing he doesn't have charge over is the food that that Potiphar is eating. And again, this is a contrast with Judah. Remember with Judah, he promised Tamar, he said, I have a third son, and I will give him to you in marriage. And what does he fulfill that promise? Is he faithful to that? No, he is not faithful. So Judah is not faithful, and yet here's Joseph, extremely faithful, to the point where his own master puts everything in his charge. So I like to think of this Joseph story, I call it Joseph's roller coaster. And the reason is because he goes low and then he gets high, and then he goes low and then he gets high, and you think it's good, and then he goes low again. And so we see he's been sold into slavery, so I would say that this is a low. But then God starts blessing him, so things are getting a little bit better. But if we look at the next verse, the next part of verse 6, we can see an ominous tone. It says, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So now this is setting us up for a potential fall here. His rise is potentially short-lived. We keep reading, it says, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused. And he said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in this house than I, and he's withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? As she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or to be with her. So Joseph now is at this kind of pivotal point, and he's being tested. This is a test. How is he going to handle it? He's being tempted. And I think there's some interesting things we can draw out from this. One is, the first time I read this, you know what this made me think of? This made me think of Adam in the garden. And here's why. How many things was Adam allowed to do in the garden? Everything. How many restrictions did he have? One restriction. The only restriction was the tree. And what's going on here with Joseph? The same thing. He's got the responsibility. He can do whatever he wants, except you can't touch the master's wife. Clearly. However, we know with Adam and Eve, they fall to that one temptation. The one thing that they're told not to do, they can't handle it. But Joseph here, he refuses the one temptation. So he's almost, in a way, a mini type of Adam fulfilling this. I think something else that's instructful for all of us is looking at how does he actually fight this temptation? I mean, we all have temptations, and this is a sexual temptation, and that's common for everybody in this room. Look at verse 9 again. Joseph is saying, "There's no one greater in this house than I, and he," meaning his master, "has withheld nothing from me except you because you're his wife." So Joseph is doing something important here. He's thinking about the consequences of sin. He's thinking, what would happen if I do this? He's not being impulsive like we saw Judah was impulsive last week. He's thinking about this. And even more so, I call it, he's thinking about the other. Sexual sin, especially, is the type of thing where a person who's being tempted and lured into it, you just start thinking about yourself. I want this. I desire this. I'm craving this. I need to fulfill whatever desire. But Joseph is thinking about the other. He's thinking about, well, Potiphar's giving me everything that I have. Yeah, this isn't a great situation, being in Potiphar's house, but he's put everything that he has in my charge. Am I going to really do this to him? And this is instructful, and this is helpful for me, too. I've been meeting with a number of young men who are pastors or aspiring to be pastors, and they made us do an exercise thinking about this type of sexual sin. And the point of the exercise was to show us how many people are impacted by sexual sin. You think it's just like maybe you, or maybe it doesn't hurt anybody. But they said, if you're going to be a pastor, then write on a piece of paper, if you were to have an affair with your wife, how many people would be impacted by that? And at first you're like, okay, let's see. And then you say, well, my wife. Okay, absolutely. And then you say, well, my children. And then you say, well, whoever the other person's spouse, okay, and their children, okay? And then you start to think, well, I got cousins who look up to me. They would be impacted by this. And then, well, who are the people in the congregation? They would be impacted by this. And there's some children in this congregation. And it just spirals, and you see a lot of people are impacted. So that exercise was so helpful in seeing others, the others who get impacted by the consequences of sin. And so Joseph, he's doing that. He's thinking, I would not do this to Potiphar. But he goes a step farther. He's thinking about Potiphar, but who else is he focused on? Verse 9, there's no one greater in this house than I. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then, and then look what he says, could I do this great evil and sin against God? So not only is Joseph thinking about the other on a horizontal level, he's thinking about the vertical level. How could I do this thing and sin against God? And I think this is amazing for such a young man, because by this time he's probably like only 20 or so. And remember his situation. He is far from home. There's nobody watching over his shoulder, right? And you could think he's even might be resentful. God, you let this happen to me. You let me be sold into slavery. But that's not what he says. He's holding firm to his trust and his relationship with God. And that intimate relationship with God is the very thing that he says, how could I sin against my God doing this? And to me, this kind of echoes what we hear in Psalm 51, where David is confessing his sin. He says, he's praying and he says, against you, God, you only I've sinned. But this is his sin against Uriah the Hittite and Bathsheba. Well, clearly he's sinned against other people. But he's so focused on, I've broken God's law. This hurts God's heart. So thinking about sinning against God keeps him from this. It's also interesting to note, if you look here in verse, I think 10, it says, and she spoke to Joseph, and look, this was not a one-time thing. What does it say? Day after day. And that's instructful. Sin, sometimes even when you resist sin, it's going to come back. This isn't just a one-time thing. It's like when you're hitting what's that game, the whack-a-mole? They just keep popping back up. So this is a day-after-day thing. But notice, he did not listen to her. He didn't listen to her. And this is an important concept right here. So come with me for a second, and I want to show you how, again, Joseph is in a way kind of fulfilling some things we've seen earlier in Genesis. So hold your place here. And come with me, let's go to look at Genesis 3, way in the beginning, verse 17. So I'm talking about how he did not listen to her. And in Genesis 3, this is Adam and Eve when they fall to temptation in the garden. And if you remember, the first one to fall is Eve. But then she gets Adam to join in. And if you look at verse 17, it says, Then to Adam God said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded, saying, you shall not eat it. And then he goes on to lay out these curses. Because you've listened to the voice of your wife. Same language. He did not listen to her. But then this theme continues on. Let's go now fast forward to Genesis 16. So Adam listens to the voice of his wife is the phrase used. And then Genesis 16, now we get to Abraham and Sarah. And if you know their story, God promised them a son. It's taking quite a long time. And now Sarah has the idea, let's do this on our own here. Let's take this into our own hands. And 16 verse 1 says, now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her. And then look, and Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. So we've got this theme, listening to the voice, listening to the voice. And then we can come back to Genesis 39. Joseph does not listen to the voice. He does not listen to the voice. Now I need to think, I think I have to put a disclaimer here. Husbands, this is not saying don't listen to your wives. But if she's trying to get you to sin, do not listen to her. And we see this even in Ephesians when it's talking about husbands and wives. It tells the wife to be subject to your husband as to the Lord. Meaning the wife, yes, listen to your husband. As to the Lord, if he's trying to get you to sin, you don't listen. So again, here's Joseph. He's kind of fulfilling these things. He's closing some of these loops. So he doesn't listen to her day after day. And look, it gets even better. He does not listen to her. Look back in verse 10. He did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Meaning, he's not even putting himself in her presence. He's trying to avoid her. At all costs. And how instructive for us is this in dealing with sin? Basically saying, don't go somewhere where you know you're going to be tempted. If you know you've got a weakness or you know that there's a potential for temptation somewhere, why would you even put yourself in that situation? And you see, Joseph chooses not to. This makes me think of Proverbs 6:27, one of my favorite. It says, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Right? Can you take fire in your lap, burning coals, and expect that you're not going to catch fire? Of course. Don't even put yourself in a tempting situation. So Joseph's being tested, and he's doing pretty good, but it gets a little harder. Look at verse 11. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household were there inside. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. This is like the perfect scene. He's doing his work like normal. He comes into the house maybe to grab something. And the usual hustle and bustle of servants coming in and out, it's not there. Every time I read this, I just picture it's like eerily quiet. But out of that quiet just comes that voice, lie with me. It's like the cat trying to get the mouse. She grabs him. She catches him by his garment, lie with me. And what does he do, though? He leaves his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. He did some sort of magic trick to get out of this thing, and she's left holding the garment, and he's not in it. And again, the New Testament talks about this all the time. 2 Timothy 2. Flee from youthful lusts. Flee. 1 Corinthians 6:18. Flee sexual immorality. And then I love this. 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. There is a way of escape. There's a window there for you to get out, and we must flee like Joseph does here. So he doesn't even play with this. He flees, and for the second time, Joseph is now disrobed. The brothers took his robe off of him, and now Potiphar's wife has taken his robe off of him for the second time. If I was him, I wouldn't buy any more robes. Again, I'm impressed by his maturity at such a young age to withstand something like this. And then again, another contrast here with Judah. Judah, if you remember that story, he was on the roadside to go shear his sheep, and his daughter-in-law dressed like a prostitute and was standing on the side of the road. And really, it doesn't even say that she said anything. She didn't even necessarily solicit him, but he was passing by, and he sees it, and he's tempted, and he goes right for it. Yet Joseph is being actively pursued, and he constantly is able to push it away and flee and reject and run. Yet again, another contrast. Sam Amati, he's a pastor and author, he wrote, "Joseph's purity is the foil to Judah's promiscuity." And another commentator said, "Whereas Joseph refuses the temptation that accosts him day after day, Judah is tempted because his temptress knows he's the kind of man to pursue immorality repeatedly." So Joseph, he passes the test. He gets past. He doesn't fall for it. Okay, now how is this going to go? We pick it up in verse 13. "When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, 'See, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside.' So she left his garment beside her until his master came home." So Potiphar's wife is embarrassed by the rejection, and she resorts to false accusations and lying. And for the second time, Joseph's garment is used to deceive someone. It's used against him. The brothers used his robe dipped in blood to deceive their father. And now here we go, Potiphar's wife using Joseph's robe to deceive others, falsely accuse him. So Joseph's falsely accused, and I think it's also interesting, let's just look at her language here. We see in verse 13, she saw that he fled, called to the men of her house. Verse 14, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us." Who's he? This is her husband. Look what he did. What is this? This is blame shifting. She's the guilty party, and is this not our natural tendency? Well, it was not my fault. He did it. He put me in this situation. Kind of makes me think about, again, Adam in the garden. What does he tell God when he sins? "The woman you gave me." And have you ever, if you have children, have you ever had maybe one of your children misbehave and you find yourself saying, "Your son did this"? Right? So she's shifting the blame, and she's waiting for her husband to get home. And let's see, she continues this in verse 17. "Then she spoke to him, her husband, with these words, 'The Hebrew slave, whom you brought to us, came in to me to make sport of me. And I raised my voice and screamed, and he left his garment beside me and fled outside.'" The perpetrator is now pleading that she's the victim. And again, she's saying, "This is your fault." Now the question is Potiphar going to buy this? What do we think? Does he know his wife? Verse 19. "Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, 'This is what your slave did to me,' his anger burned." Uh-oh. His anger burned. This isn't looking good for Joseph. But look, it says, "So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail." Now, this is my opinion, and numerous commentators agree here. This burning with anger, this is not at Joseph. This is at his wife. She's accusing him. She's putting the blame on him. And as we saw, he had given all responsibility to Joseph. He trusts Joseph. And I'm assuming, living with her for a long time, he knows his wife. But now Potiphar's put in a sticky situation here. I can't call my wife out on this, so I have to do something about it. And remember, what is Potiphar's title? What's his role? Executioner. Now you tell me, if you're the executioner and you think a slave that you bought tried to take a pass at your wife, what would happen? His head would be rolling on the floor. But no, he just puts him into the prison. And not only that, he puts him in the place where the king's prisoners are confined. So I think this is our clue that Potiphar knows what's really going on here. Now, I said the king's prisoners are confined, and that's an important detail to note. This is important because, again, Potiphar could have put Joseph anywhere. He could have executed him. He could have put him in some other prison, but he puts him in a place where the king's prisoners are confined. And I think here we're seeing, again, God's providential hand is over this story of Joseph. He providentially put Joseph into Potiphar's house in the first place and nowhere else, and now he's putting him where the king's prisoners are confined. The same pastor, Sam Amati, here's how he puts it. The further Joseph descends in social rank, the closer he gets to the throne. So his social status is decreasing. This is looking worse and worse. Yet, he's getting a little bit closer to Pharaoh. A little bit closer. It's also important, I think we notice here, Joseph did the right thing. He resisted the temptation. Yet, he still finds himself in a difficult spot, and I think the thing we can learn here is just because we resist and just because we do what we're supposed to doesn't always mean things just work out all warm and fuzzy. Sometimes resisting temptation makes things worse, but it still is clearly right. So Joseph's been on this roller coaster. He was doing well in Potiphar's house, and then Potiphar's wife got involved, and now we're descending. And let's see how this goes for him in 21. So now he's in the prison, but look what it says. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. So even though he's descending in the social rank, even though he's outwardly looks like everything is going worse and worse and worse, God is still with him. God is still with him through this whole thing. He has the favor of Potiphar at first, and now he's got the favor of the jailer at first. Now, and just think about how kind of ridiculous this is. If you were a jailer, you're just going to put one of the slaves in charge of everything? You're just like, here's the keys, buddy. You know, do what you wish. But God, this is God involved here. He's supernaturally giving Joseph this success, even though he's suffering for it. Okay, now I do want to continue into chapter 40. I think we can get through it. It kind of adds to this. We're seeing, okay, well, he's now going into prison. How is he going to do? So far, maybe he's doing decent. So let's continue here. 40, verse 1. Then it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And it says, Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. So Joseph's spending some time in prison, and now he gets some new inmates. He's got some new cell buddies. One of them is the cupbearer, and one of them is the baker. So if you know anything about what these roles are, the cupbearer's role is what? What's the cupbearer do? Test the wine. He's overseeing the drink that comes to the king's table. And the baker, he's overseeing the food and the baked goods that are coming to the king's table. And this is extremely important because through the food and through the wine are two easy ways that people would try to assassinate the king. So this is an important role, but every time I think about cupbearer, I think about Just imagine what a role this is. Okay, buddy, your job is taste the wine, see if it's poisoned. But I don't think you taste the poison. I don't think that's how you find out. So Joseph is in prison, and the cupbearer and the baker, they're both thrown in prison. We don't exactly know why they're there. It doesn't tell us explicitly. You know, a couple of things we could think about is maybe Pharaoh simply got sick. Maybe the food was bad, and so he's saying, you know what, we need to investigate this, and he puts both of them in prison. Maybe there was a conspiracy to kill him that they discovered, right? And so they say, we're going to hold these two guys until the air clears. Or maybe he simply just was upset with the way they handled something. He's the Pharaoh. He can do what he wants. We don't exactly know why, but somehow both the cupbearer and the baker land in the same prison with Joseph. And so now, as we continue in verse 5, we see things are going to change here for the cupbearer and the baker. It says, verse 5, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in the jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream, and each dream with his own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. He asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? Then they said to him, we have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. And Joseph said, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. So the cupbearer and the baker each have a dream, but they don't know what the dreams mean. And as we'll find out, the dreams are very similar. And in this ancient Near East time, they believed you needed to be an expert to be able to understand these dreams. No normal person could do this. You had to have training. Later on, we'll see Pharaoh. He's got particular wise men and magicians who are trained to understand dreams. And so they're upset because they're like, well, nobody's here to help us understand what do these dreams mean. But Joseph steps up. And I think in the darkness of this dungeon, this is the light we see, that Joseph is still clinging to his hope in God. He's still trusting God because look what he says. Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? He's witnessing for God in a prison here. I find that amazing. But it's also showing us that he's still clinging to his dreams that God gave him before. God gave him dreams saying that you're going to one day rise up. And though everything seems to be falling apart, he's still clinging to that. And he's still trusting God. To the point where he's willing to boldly say, who cares about your wise men? Interpretations belong to God. And he's got the confidence to say, God, I can do that. God's given me this ability. Tell it to me, please. So his willingness to interpret the dreams shows he hasn't stopped trusting God. And so the cupbearer now told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in his hand, so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. So Joseph interprets this first dream. He's got this dream of these branches, and then we have some blossoms come and grapes come, and Pharaoh's cup is there, and the cupbearer squeezes the grapes into it, and he puts the cup into Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph gives him a favorable interpretation and says, hey, good news, buddy. You're going back to your job. You're not going to be in here for very long, 3 days, and you're going back. And then we see in verse 14, Joseph now, he knows, okay, this guy's going back. Maybe something could work out for me here. This is like the only plea we see of Joseph. Look what he says. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you. Please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon. He sees that he's got a chance here. Put a good word in for me. You're going back. Remember me. And it's interesting, this word kindness, this is hesed. He's saying, he's almost relying on this man's faithfulness. Be faithful to me, please. Remember me. This is like the only plea we see of Joseph. He's pleading, I was not supposed to be here. Please help me get out. Don't forget me, is what he's saying. Now when we get to verse 16, so the first guy, the cupbearer, he's got a good interpretation. So now if you're the baker, you're thinking, okay, we're on to something here. Let's do my dream. I'm up next. Verse 16, when the chief baker saw that he interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. Pretty good so far. And the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Now, if you know the Bible, birds are often not a good sign. Then Joseph answered and said, this is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. I don't know whose face would be more surprising, Joseph or the baker. But he and I also can't imagine how Joseph would deliver this news, but he delivers it straight up and he says, I don't have good news for you here. 3 more days and you're going to be hanged. And so we continue in verse 20. How does this turn out? Thus it came about on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted. So the 3 days go by, Pharaoh has a birthday, and he restores the cupbearer, and he hangs the baker. I think they got to the bottom of who was involved maybe with the plot. Now this is important for Joseph because this is him interpreting a dreams. And remember, again, he's holding on to his original dreams. And think about your life when there's been something so obvious that God has done for you. It's clearly, God did this for me. But then the weeks go by, and the months go by, and the years go by, and you start kind of questioning yourself. Was that God? Was that just, maybe that was just a coincidence? You start questioning yourself. But Joseph here, he's getting encouragement that, no, I knew what those dreams were. Because I was able to interpret these, and they came to pass, as I said. So those dreams I had, those are real. So on Joseph's roller coaster now, I'd say he's finally getting back up the highest part he's been in the prison, where he interpreted these well. He's feeling good about himself. But he's at that peak, and it's going to plummet. Take a look at the next verse. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So the chief cupbearer, he gets the good news. 3 days later, I'm out of here. See you guys. Nice to meet you. He goes off. He's restored, and in his excitement, he completely forgets about Joseph. Joseph's one request, don't forget me. And he's forgotten. Now, Joseph's up and downs in his story, this kind of reminds me of a book that actually someone in our congregation gave to me, Imprisoned with ISIS, Faith in the Face of Evil. This man, he's involved with the Voice of the Martyrs. It's a ministry organization that helps persecuted Christians around the world. You know, we have freedom here to be Christians, but you go in another country, it is not the same. And so he goes to this to Sudan, I believe, and he's helping this organization. He gets to the airport to come home. He thinks he's got a few hour flight to get back home, and he gets stopped going through the airport checkout line, through the line, and they pull him aside, and they start questioning him. And then while he's in the room, they start showing him pictures of everything he was doing while he was there. They had been tracking him the whole time because he was doing some underground meeting with pastors and stuff. So he thought he was a few hours from home, and he ends up 445 days in a prison in Sudan, away from his family. And he's not just in the prison. He comes to find out that the first cell he gets put in, his cellmates are extremist ISIS members. And they find out he's a Christian, and over time, their violence escalates, and they eventually get to torturing him and beating him, and he finally barely gets out. And then through his journey in this 445 days, he's put in different cells and different prisons around the world. And it just makes me think of Joseph. He constantly is thinking he's going to get out. He's always like, oh, maybe, you know, this will be the day I'll get out, and it doesn't happen. When he finally gets out, And at the end of this book, here's how he reflects on this time. Let me read this. In March 2016, when I thought I was going to be released, I felt frustrated with God for keeping me in prison. I wanted to go home to be with my family. I wanted to go back to my church in the Czech Republic and worship with them like before. But after prison, I saw the situation in a different way. The Lord had better things in store for me. He was keeping me in Sudan for a reason. He was preparing me to preach the gospel at Omdurman prison, at Al Huda prison, at Kober, to show the love of God to my interrogators and lawyers in the courts. God's timing is better than our own. When I stopped thinking about myself, I stopped feeling miserable and I saw the larger plan taking shape. He keeps going, for me, my experiences in the prison in Sudan were a profound opportunity to proclaim Christ, even if it brought personal pain. I've learned that God sometimes allows us to walk through the valley of the shadow of death to teach us to trust in His strength instead of trusting in our own. It is only in the valley, in the shadows, in the darkness, that we see Christ shining the brightest. The more helpless, hopeless, defenseless we are, the more our ears are tuned to the voice of the shepherd as His rod, His staff, and His footprints lead the way. And he basically says at the end, 4 months after my arrest, when God gave me the opportunity, 4 months into his arrest, God gave him an opportunity to witness the gospel to 12 men. And when he saw them come to Christ, I had a complete change of mind. Up until that time, all I could think about was going home and being free. But as I began telling those men about the love of Christ and saw them respond in obedience to God, I suddenly realized, what are 4 months in prison compared to an eternity in heaven? And so I think that is exactly what Joseph is feeling here. The ups and downs, yet he is still staying true to God. And I believe at this point, Joseph understands that no matter what's going on, he has been sent here by God. He's in this prison on purpose. And like I said in the beginning, sometimes God will put his most faithful servants through these most difficult trials to refine them and to use them. He's always got a purpose in mind, whether we end up knowing it or not. So although Joseph is forgotten by the cupbearer, as we're going to see next week, he's not forgotten by God. And we can end there. Will you join me in prayer? Thank you, Father, for this time again this evening. What a wonderful story of Joseph, Lord. The story is wonderful and it's instructive in so many ways. Particularly in this story, we see your testing. And we see that being faithful to you does not always mean things will go well. Sometimes, in fact, they get worse. But thank you for giving us Joseph's example of a man who is faithful to you. He's trusting you even in the valley. I pray, Lord, that we would grow to be like this, that we would trust you, that we know that your ways are higher than our ways. Even if we can't see your plan, even if things are taking longer than we expect, we can always rest assured that you are working and you are good. Thank you, Father, for this day. In your name we pray. Amen.